This week, a good friend and longtime guest on Issues Etc., Dr. Kenneth Bailey, died. We present the following encore in his memory. We definitely saved the most difficult for last in this series on interpreting parables. The unjust steward has been a puzzle to pastors and preachers and students of the Bible. Is Jesus commending this man for being what appears to be completely dishonest, for cheating his now former employer, for basically using his former employer to get himself a better position now that he's been fired? It's the kind of stuff that would land you in jail if you did it nowadays in business. And yet this man does it, and Jesus apparently commends him for it. The parable of the unjust steward, the conclusion of our five-part daily series on interpreting parables with Dr. Ken Bailey. Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. It's Friday afternoon, August the 12th. We're concluding our series, recorded back in 1999, with Dr. Ken Bailey, author and lecturer in Middle Eastern New Testament studies. He spent 40 years living and teaching New Testament in Egypt, Lebanon, Jerusalem, and Cyprus, and he's author of numerous books, including Finding the Lost, Cultural Keys to Luke 15. Now, here's the parable, all 13 verses. The real question here for Dr. Bailey at the beginning, where should the parable end? This is Luke 16, beginning with the first verse. And he also said to his disciples, "There was a rich man who had a manager, and charges were brought to him that this manager was wasting his possessions. And he called him and said to him, 'What is this that I hear about you? Turn in an account of your management, for you can no longer be manager.' And the manager said to himself, 'What shall I do, since my master is taking the management away from me? I'm not strong enough to dig. I'm ashamed to beg. I have decided what to do, so that when I am removed from management, people may receive me into their houses.' So, summoning his master's debtors one by one, he said to the first, 'How much do you owe my master?' And he said, 100 measures of oil. And he said to him, 'Take your bill, sit down, and quickly write 50. And he said to another, 'How much do you owe?' And he said, 100 measures of wheat. And he said to him, 'Take your bill and write 80. The master commended the dishonest manager for his shrewdness, for the sons of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own generation than the sons of light. And I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth, so that when it fails, they may receive you into eternal dwellings.'" Now there, the parable may or may not stop. Verse 10, "One who is faithful in very little is also faithful in much, and one who is dishonest in very little is also dishonest in much. If then you have not been faithful in unrighteous wealth, who will entrust to you true riches? And if you have not been faithful in what is another's, who will give you that which is your own? No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money." Our conversation with Dr. Ken Bailey began with the question, does this parable end at verse 8, or, as I read, at verse 13?
See, this is one of the critical turning points of interpretation of the story. It has traditionally been seen as a parable and then a commentary by Jesus on the parable at the end. But it is also possible to see that the parable is one subject and that a little poem about mammon is a related subject, but in fact a new topic.
So we would go to verse 8, then, if we just read the parable alone.
That's right. And then, see, I think that there is a whole list, a significant list of differences between the fellow that can be called the steward, who is the fellow who is the unrighteous steward or unjust steward, and then the man with mammon, I call him. And, for example, the steward, the parable, it's a steward and a master and a problem between them. In the man who has mammon, namely a stack of money that he doesn't know what to do with or doesn't know how to deal with appropriately, there is no master and there is no steward and no problem between them. The steward is penniless. He hasn't got anything, and he considers begging and farm labor. the man with mammon has got a big stack of money, and he's offered advice to how to spend it. And I've got eight of these that show that this is quite a different scene, that the steward is one thing. He's caught with his hand in the till, and he's been cheating his master, and what's going to happen to him? And then the man with mammon is told, hey, you'd better spend your money in a way that will please God, because that's God has given it to you, and you're responsible to him. It belongs to him and not to you. Quite different. And if you read them as the second one is often seen as an interpretation of the first, then you foul up both of them.
Let's go through the parable. I will read it, and then feel free at the end of the reading, Dr. Bailey, to correct any points of translation, as we usually do in this series.
Sure, fine.
Starting Luke 16, verses 1, now he was also saying to the disciples, there was a certain rich man who had a steward, and the steward was reported to him as squandering his possessions. And he called him and said to him, what is this I hear about you? Give an account of your stewardship, for you can no longer be a steward. And the steward said to him, what shall I do, since my master is taking the stewardship away from me? I am not strong enough to dig. I am ashamed to beg. I know what I shall do, and that when I am removed from the stewardship, they will receive me into their homes. And he summoned each of his master's debtors and began to say to the first, how much do you owe my master? And he said, 100 measures of oil. And he said to him, quickly take your bill and sit down and write 50. And he said to another, how much do you owe? And he said, 100 measures of wheat. And he said to him, take your bill and write 80. And his master praised the unrighteous steward because he had acted shrewdly. For the sons of this age are more shrewd in their relations to their own kind than the sons of light. That is Luke 16, verses 1 through 8, the parable of the unjust steward. First of all, any corrections in the translation?
Just one brief one, Todd, and that is, he summoned his master's debtors one by one. This is a real important turn in the story, in that the steward doesn't want a group meeting. He doesn't want these people interacting with each other, because if they do, they might figure out the games he's playing, and they'll walk out the door and the whole thing collapses. So he calls them in one by one, and all he has to do is eyeball it with one guy at a time, and he's got a certain kind of authority he has in relation to these people who've been renting land from the master, and so he can pull the thing off. That's a real critical cultural turning point that your translation makes a little bit fuzzy.
Yeah, my translation was he summoned each of them.
Yeah, okay, that's right, they've got it. But it's one by one makes clear that it's no group meeting. That's the last thing that this rascal wants.
In the few minutes we have before we go to our first break, describe what it is this institution of stewardship is. Is it merely a manager of money? What exactly is it in ancient Near East culture?
All right, now here's another, Todd, one of the really critical watersheds of the story. Is it a story about bankers, or is it a story about farmers? If it's a story about bankers, then we're talking about moneylenders. All right, now the word that we have here, oikonomos in Greek, can be understood as bankers, and it can be understood as an estate manager, a fellow who's running a large agricultural estate for somebody who owns the land. Well, if you decide it's bankers, you're going to go one way. If you decide that this is an agricultural scene and he is an estate manager, you're going to go another way, and you will end up with quite a different understanding.
Which way do you go, Dr. Bell?
I go down the side of farmers. The thing does talk about land rents, and it talks about how much oil do you own and how much wheat do you owe. And so it's a farming kind of a situation, and Middle Eastern Christians, from the old Syriac down through the Arabic versions all through the centuries, have, without exception, all through history, read this. They've translated it with words that mean estate manager. They've never seen this as a story about bankers.
Why do we always immediately jump to the conclusion that this is about the lending of money?
Well, I think because there's people who say, aha, this is the solution to the story. It looks like that Jesus is praising a guy who is a liar and a thief. And so you know, whenever this comes up in the liturgy, why you usually, pastors usually preach from the epistle that week. You know, they just, this one is a knuckle buster and you don't want to deal with it. So,
right. So
one of the solutions has been, it's bankers. Bankers means moneylenders. This character has been charging too much interest. And so when he gets in trouble, he all of a sudden turns the page and starts becoming an honest man. And he starts charging a reasonable interest. And the master says, you finally quit playing dirty tricks on these poor people that we're lending money to. And so, of course, then he's praised for all of a sudden turning a new leaf in his life and starting to be honest. So it looks like that solves our problem. But actually, the story is more subtle and more powerful than that.
So one of two things is going on here in this parable. Either this man has been dishonest in the past, and essentially he's lowering everyone's bill because he'd been overcharging them. That would be the moneylender's scenario. Or perhaps it's farmers and farmers' estates, and in that case, my goodness, what is going on? He's not cheating these people. He's cheating his master, or he knows something about his master. And his actions display what he knows about this master. We'll get an answer to that question on the other side of this break. It's our 1999 series conclusion on interpreting parables with Dr. Ken Bailey. Today, the very difficult parable of the unjust steward. Dr. Ken Bailey is author and lecturer in Middle Eastern New Testament studies. He spent 40 years living and teaching New Testament in Egypt, Lebanon, Jerusalem, and Cyprus. And he's authored the book Finding the Lost: Cultural Keys to Luke 15.
This is a message for members of Thrivent Financial for Lutherans. Thrivent Financial has a new charitable grant program called Thrivent Choice. Thrivent Choice allows you to designate charitable outreach funds to Lutheran Public Radio. For more information, look for the Thrivent logo under the Donate page of our website, issuesetc.org, or ask your Thrivent representative about Thrivent Choice. Help support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. with Thrivent Choice.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Would you like to share something you've heard on Issues Etc. via email, Facebook, Twitter, or text message? We've made it easy for you. Just go to the Listen On Demand page of our website, issuesetc.org, and click Share This. You'll find almost 50 ways to share Issues Etc. audio. We love our on-demand listeners. Old Theology, New Technology, issuesetc.org. Go to the Listen On Demand page and click Share This.
The 500th anniversary of the Lutheran Reformation is fast approaching. We have such a rich history as Lutherans, and many people don't realize that. The CLCC offers a seminar called Your Reformation Walk that teaches that rich heritage and helps you appreciate it. The CLCC also offers other seminars designed to help laity learn to appreciate what Lutherans believe, teach, and confess. So invite us to your church. Visit theclcc.org and get details on scheduling a seminar for your church today.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. It's Friday afternoon, August the 12th. We're concluding a five-part daily series we've been doing all this week from 1999 with Dr. Ken Bailey on interpreting parables. Today, we are tackling one of the toughest of them all, the parable of the unjust steward. Our conversation with Dr. Bailey continues. He says, if it's money lenders that he is settling accounts with, then he is simply stopping his usury. his overcharging on their accounts. But if, and I think this will lead us in a very interesting direction with this parable, if it's farmers and farmers' estates that he's dealing with, well, then what's going on?
Okay, the thing starts, we've got to kind of tell a little bit of the story and see what's behind it.
Mm-hmm.
The rich man has a steward. Charges were brought. Okay, passive. What does this mean? This means the community sees that this steward is cheating the master blind, and the community comes in and says to the nobleman who owns the land, hey, this character is really ripping you off. Now, that means that the master is not a partner in crime. He is honored, respected, and loved in the community. Or they would say, let these thieves cheat each other. What's it to us? So that's a real important point of turning. And then the community is introduced, and again in the parables of Jesus, the critical turning point is the presence of the community. Okay, so now what is the master going to do now that the community is telling him the steward is really cheating you and we're noticing this because we got our ears a bit closer to the ground? He calls him in and he says, what is this that I've been hearing about you? This is a classical Middle Eastern one-liner. What he's trying to do is shake the guy's cage, scare him into starting to sort of, you know, start talking. Well, I don't know what you've heard, and maybe you heard this, and maybe I was talking to so-and-so, and I didn't mean to criticize you, and you may have heard this and this and this. If he starts talking, he'll give the master all kinds of information the master doesn't have.
So, in other words, the master is ambiguous enough with the accusation against this unjust steward so as to bring forth all kinds of information to see everything the steward was up to.
He knows that the community is telling him the truth. He knows that the guy is a liar and a thief. He's probably suspected him before this. But his first attempt is, I say, a classical stylistic way of trying to get the guy to start talking. And maybe he can get information he doesn't have. But it doesn't work. This guy is smart. And he's smart enough to keep his mouth shut. And he doesn't say a single word. He doesn't reply to the question. And he does not obey the command. What is this I've been hearing about you? Tell me. Okay, he keeps quiet. So the master says, okay, you're not going to give me any information? Fine, I've got all the information I need anyway. And he says, turn in the books. Turn in the accounts doesn't mean balance the books. The books are already cooked. It means turn them in. Now, when the guy turns them in, then he can, of course, no longer pull any tricks. But the steward then says to himself, ah, this is the steward on his way to his office to get the books and bring them back and turn them in. And on his way to the office, he has a little soliloquy. And he says to himself, my master is taking the stewardship away from me. All right, here's another absolutely critical turning point, and that is, does this guy have authority or is he fired? Well, the law, according to the Mishnah, this collection of Jewish laws written down in a book about the year 200 A.D., tells us what the Jewish law of the time was in the first century. And it says that if the master tells the steward, you're fired, he has no authority from that point on, even if the people that the steward is dealing with don't know. Or if he tells the people, steward's out of town, I'm firing this guy, anything the steward does from that moment on is illegal, even though the steward hasn't gotten the word. So when this guy walks out of the master's office, he's fired. Everything he does from now on is illegal. So he says, well, I'm not strong enough to dig. That means work as a day laborer. I'm ashamed to beg. We're grateful that he's got some honor left. And so, I know what I'm going to do so that when I get kicked out, I can get another job. And so we're not told what his trick is going to be. How's he going to walk out of there and get another job? The light bulb goes on in the sort of, the scene here, but we discover what his trick is as the story proceeds.
So he's keeping his own counsel up to verse 4.
That's right.
I know what I will do, but he doesn't tell us and the hearers of the parable, when they're hearing this from Jesus' mouth, they don't know what he's going to do either.
Absolutely.
What might they suspect he's going to do?
Well, there's a whole series of sort of classical tricks that they think he's going to do. They think, well, he's going to try and argue rumors. yes, he's going to go back to the master and say, well, anybody with authority over money makes enemies, and my enemies have told you lies, and let's discuss it. Or he can call for a confrontation. He'll say, now, you these people who've been telling you that I'm cheating, why, you bring them in here and see if they've got the guts to say this in front of me. Now, of course, if the steward wins the debate, then these people are going to be in trouble. And he knows that. Or they can say, well, let's look at the books. The books are perfect. You'll see that everything is in order. The accountants won't have any trouble. Every receipt is in its place. Or he can say, look, I have served you, O my master, all my life, and my father served your father, and my grandfather served your grandfather, and we're not going to let this beautiful relationship that's gone for over a century between our two families be ruined over a little thing like money. I mean, you're far too great a man to let that happen. All classical tricks. Or he can blame others. He can say, now these people around me are all liars and thieves, and I'm the only honest man in the house, and I can't watch everything. Or he can say, now look, you weren't here. You left me too, you're too preoccupied. I didn't have good instructions. You didn't give me enough authority. I don't have 1,000 eyes. I can't watch everything. I'm doing my best. Can't you back me up? Or he goes out and then he sends in the mayor, and he sends in the local priest, and he sends in the rabbi, and he sends in the big money lenders, the banker, and he sends in the landowners, and they all walk in and say to the master, now we understand that you've got a little personal misunderstanding with your steward, and that we don't want any trouble in the village, and I'm sure we can work all of this out. These are the things that the audience expects him to do.
So they would expect him, to summarize, to either appeal to the fact that these are rumors about him, to seek a confrontation with those who are his accusers.
Yes.
To try and make the best show of the accounting that he can.
Right.
To a sentimental tie between he himself and his master.
Absolutely.
To blame others and their dishonesty, or to
yep.
blame his master.
Yes.
And plead incompetence in sense.
Yeah.
Or to bring in character references.
Very good.
Would those have been socially acceptable solutions to this problem, according to the hearers of the parable initially?
They were, and they still are. These are the classic tricks of somebody who's going to get fired. And firing somebody in this kind of a scene in villages in the Middle East takes you about 3 days. Because no is not an answer. It's a pause in the negotiations. What he does is absolutely astounding. Very, very risky. Extremely dangerous. It's a signal of a very intelligent man. He, first of all, he goes back to his office. Now, nobody knows he's fired except himself. Jewish law says everything he now does is illegal, but the people he deals with haven't got the word. Okay, he's got a little bit of time, and pretty soon word is going to get out. One more visitor to the master, and everybody in the village is going to know he's fired. But right now, no, they think he's in authority. So it says he summoned his master's debtors one by one. Now, he doesn't go and knock on their doors. He asks them to come and see him. There's no telephone. How does he get the word out? He sends the other staff, go tell these people to come and see me. Why do they go? Obviously, because they think he's still in authority. That's the message he wants them to take indirectly to everybody. Okay, so he gets them there. He brings them in one by one because, as we mentioned earlier, he doesn't want a group meeting. Now, he's got in the drawer of his desk all of the accounts. So he pulls one out, and he looks at it, and he says to the fellow standing in front of him, how much do you owe my master? He's not looking for information. He's looking for confirmation, because he's got the figure right in front of him.
I see.
That is, he's saying to him, and I've watched this happen in villages, do you agree that what we negotiated last spring early before you started planting, that the figure that I have on this piece of paper is the one that we verbally negotiated, or are you going to accuse me of having fiddled with it? And the guy says, okay, I owe 100 measures. And then the steward says, fine, all right, take your bill, sit down quickly, and write 50. Now, he wants it done quickly because very soon the word is going to get out that he's fired, and then these people will not cooperate. And he wants it in their handwriting. Very important. Not in his handwriting.
We're talking about the parable of the unjust steward, concluding our series with Dr. Ken Bailey this week on interpreting parables. When we come back, we've come to two important points here. Everyone is about to find out that this man has been fired. He's the only one who knows besides his master or his former master. And he's getting these guys to write out the new deal, the new financial arrangement, in their own handwriting. That's important. We'll find out why on the other side of the break. Dr. Ken Bailey is author of numerous books, including Finding the Lost, Cultural Keys to Luke 15. This is a great book on these parables in Luke chapter 15. Even if you think you know them and you've studied them and heard them preached, there's new insights from the ancient culture in this book that you need to hear. Find out more about Finding the Lost at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand or call Concordia Publishing House and order Finding the Lost, Cultural Keys to Luke 15. Their toll-free number, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Why is it so important that this unjust steward is having these people write out the new financial deal in their own handwriting? We'll find out after this.
Ah, the sounds of rich liturgy and historic Christian worship. What a way to spend a Sunday morning. At Trinity Lutheran Church in Millstadt, Illinois, you'll find authentic Christianity as you hear the preaching of Christ crucified for the forgiveness of your sins. Come, join us Sunday mornings at 9 and Monday evenings at 7:30, and find out more about Trinity Lutheran Church, Millstadt, Illinois, at trinitymillstadt.org.
Did you know that you can listen to Issues Etc. 24/7? Check out our website, issuesetc.org, and go to the Listen on Demand page. Listen at the gym, in your kitchen, in your garden, on your iPod, your computer, or in your car. The technology may be new, but the truth never changes. Issues Etc. On Demand audio, available for your convenience at issuesetc.org. 10 hours of new programming each week. issuesetc.org, and click Listen on Demand.
The faith, once for all, delivered to the saints. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Pro-abortion bias in the media.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
Many states are moving to defund Planned Parenthood and place other restrictions on abortion. Such moves clearly save unborn lives. But they also rile largely pro-abortion news outlets, such as the New York Times. The paper recently referred to Planned Parenthood as advocates for women's health. It also cited Dr. David Grimes to argue that fetal pain does not exist. The paper failed to mention that he is also an abortion doctor who served on the board of the National Abortion Federation. Sometimes what is omitted from a report is as important as what's in it.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. To join us in our battle for life, visit our website at sba-list.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. Dr. Ken Bailey is our guest. We're talking about the parable of the unjust steward, concluding our weekly series with him on interpreting parables. Back to our interview, he says there are two very important points. Everyone is about to find out that this dishonest manager has been fired. They don't know it yet. And he's having all of his former master's clients write out the new financial arrangement in their own handwriting. Why is that important?
Both of those are absolutely critical aspects of what is going on. And, of course, there's a little chatter that takes place between him and each of these fellows. They say, oh, you're making a reduction now. Why, this is quite amazing. Usually we try and negotiate a reduction comes harvest time, but it's not harvest time now. What's going on? And so the steward says, yeah, well, I knew you guys were having a hard time, and the rain is kind of not very good, and the bugs are active, and so I talked the old man into making you a reduction. Oh, thanks a lot, Joe. That's really nice of you. As he signs with the big reduction, each guy gets a reduction of 500 denarii, which is the wages of a working man for a year and a half. So this is sizable, and these are wealthy people because
now,
the sums are enormous.
Why does he, these are all wealthy people.
Yes.
Why does he, first of all, want it done quickly, and then why does he want it in their handwriting?
He wants it done quickly because he knows time is running out. What he's doing is illegal. Only the people in front of him don't know it. But if they find out he's fired, they will not participate.
But if it's illegal, isn't he afraid that this will all come to naught anyway because the master will descend and say, I didn't authorize this. It's illegal, and he has the code of law behind him, and it's not these people really aren't going to get the reduction he's giving them.
That's the critical turning point of the story. That's what makes it both humorous and powerful. Let's go on just a minute, Todd.
Let's talk about the handwriting.
All right. The handwriting is, when he gets done, he's been told to go get the accounts. Okay. So when he gets done, everybody gets 500 denarii across the board, and he takes these accounts, blowing on the paper, drying the ink of the handwriting of all of his master's most important business associates. And he walks in on the master, blowing on this handwriting, and he sits there with a sly smile in front of the master and says, "Master, you wanted the accounts. Fine, here they are." The master looks at the accounts, and he sees the handwriting of all of his most important friends and business associates, and he sees that this rascal has just given everybody a year and a half's wages deduction for a working man, and there is a great party by that time going on all across the village in praise of the most generous man who ever rented land in the entire village for the last 1,000 years. Now, what is this master going to do?
Well,
he's got two choices. He can say, as you suggested, Todd, he can say, "Well, now, this is illegal. I mean, you can't do this. You were already fired. I mean, the law is behind me. This is unacceptable. I can't accept this. You were fired when this took place."
And he can look like a real schmo in front of the entire village.
Exactly. It's kind of like a teacher who, at the end of a very tough course, says to the students, "Look, I'm not going to put you people through an exam. The exam ordinarily is a 3-hour exam. You don't have to write it. Everybody just take a piece of paper and write just a few paragraphs about what you think was most important in the course, and I'll accept that, and you grade yourself." And the students go out thinking, "Oh, man, this teacher is really great. Wish we all had teachers like that." The next class period, he says, "I've changed my mind. Everybody's got to sit for the 3-hour exam." Now he's the most unreasonable, narrow-minded teacher they ever dealt with. Well, if he hadn't offered the chance to get out of the exam, then they wouldn't think this. But they're really going to grumble about him if he takes away what they perceive to have been a privilege that was given to them. That's what's happening here. The steward looks, the master looks down at the steward, and he's got two options. He keeps his mouth shut and receives the praise of the community, which is due him because he is a generous man. Now, how do we know that? We know that because the Jewish law says if anybody steals anything, if they can't pay it back, you have the right to sell them as a slave or they go to prison. All right, this guy walked out, and neither is he sold as a slave, nor is he sent off to prison. And so he says, "Look, I've robbed my master blind, and he's letting me walk out of here a free man. This is a very generous man. I think I'll put all of my eggs into that one basket. I think I will challenge him to respond in his own deepest generous fashion. And I'll do it in a clever way that is a compliment to him." All right. So now the master, with a sly smile, looks down at him and says, "Hey, you clever rascal, you really are very, very intelligent.
And you know me.
You know me. You knew I was a generous, merciful kind of a guy, and you know that I have a reputation as a generous man and that I am not going to destroy my own reputation in the village as a generous man." This fellow is like the prodigal son. He goes home knowing he has blown it, knowing he has caused all kinds of trouble, knowing he has lost the money, knowing that the community expects him to pay it back, and he, as it were, throws himself on the mercy of his father. His father responds with enormous grace and generosity, as does the master of this parable. And here's the point, really another critical turning point, Todd, and that is, did the Greek fathers in the 4th century, when they put in our chapter headings, did they get them at the right spot, or did they get them at the wrong spot?
What do you think?
I think they got, many times they have them right. In this case, I think they got it wrong. If the chapter heading for chapter 16 had begun at 16 verse 9 with the discussion of the man with mammon, we would then have read the story of the unjust steward as an add-on to the story of the prodigal son. And I think that's what should have happened. We should have read the story of the prodigal son. Here is one story of an enormously generous father who shows unqualified grace to a sinner, namely the prodigal, and doesn't ask him to earn his way back. Now we have a second story about a master who's dealing with a servant, and he gives him extraordinary grace and doesn't ask him to pay back what he's lost. And we should reflect on those two stories together.
Is there any significance to the introduction of this parable saying that Jesus was saying these things to his disciples, as opposed to the previous three parables that are apparently in response to the scribes and Pharisees in chapter 15?
Yes, that's a very good question, Todd. It's a tricky one. I don't have a really clear cut, and sort of I'm not going to go into the ditches in response to what I think is happening here. This story is a kind of a Tom and Jerry story. Jesus lived in a society in which they were overrun, but of course with Roman rule, and a story in which the clever little guy wins a big deal off the big rich man is a story everybody laughs at and everybody listens to and everybody loves. And so Jesus puts this kind of a story in. It is a little tricky if you don't understand Middle Eastern psychology. And so it is told to the disciples and not to the Pharisees because it is open to misunderstanding. And his disciples are going to give it a positive twist. His opponents might give it a negative twist. And indeed, the opponents of Jesus, for example, Julian the Apostate, who tried to turn the Roman Empire back to paganism at the end of the 4th century, one of his major reasons was, he said, look at this story about the unjust steward. Here is Jesus praising a man who is a liar and a thief, and we Romans have a noble sense of duty and responsibility and faithfulness and honesty, and we can't have this ridiculous carpenter Jesus of Nazareth teaching our people and praising people who are liars and thieves. And that misunderstanding is always there, and that's why people run scared from it in the 20th century.
So Jesus is telling this to his disciples, as you said, because it's open to misunderstanding. It's one of the trickier of the parables.
That's part of it. The other part of it is, I think that the section that comes right after it, which is the discussion of mammon, what do you do with the stack of money? And in that discussion of mammon, the verses which immediately follow, which you remember at the beginning of the program I argued is really a new subject, is the strongest statement in the entire New Testament about the importance of honesty with money. And it climaxes in the middle where it says, if you have not been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, the truth, who will entrust to you? That is, if you cheat on your income tax, you will not be able to understand the gospel. The most powerful statement about the importance of honesty with material things that we have in the entire gospel. Now, supposing you read through this story of the unjust steward, and it looks like, hey, what's going on here? Jesus is praising somebody for being a liar and a thief. No, he's not praising somebody for being a liar and a thief. He's praising somebody for knowing which way to jump.
Well, that's a great place to take a break. What does he mean he's being commended for knowing which way to jump? It really has to do with how we interpret this difficult parable of the unjust steward. Maybe it's another one that we should think about renaming. We're concluding our five-part daily series on interpreting parables. Today, the parable of the unjust steward. Dr. Ken Bailey is our guest. This interview from 1999, a True Issues, Etc. classic. We'll finish it up right after this.
Christological.
My friends, Jesus comes only for sinners.
Historical.
I believe in God the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, and in Jesus Christ, his only Son, our Lord, who was conceived by...
Sacramental.
Take and eat. This is the true body of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, given unto death for your sins.
To find a Christological, historical, and sacramental church near you, go to issuesetc.org and click Find a Church. Luther had Wartburg. We have Collinsville. You're listening to Issues Etc.
How does error find its way into the church? I've written an article in the latest edition of the online Issues Etc. journal titled From Exception to Rule, How Error Replaces Truth in the Church, and we'll send it to you for free. Just send your name and email address to journal@issuesetc.org. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Jordan Cooper details his journey from Calvinism to Lutheranism. The latest Issues Etc. journal, journal@issuesetc.org.
Here are two new ways that you can promote Issues Etc. The Issues Etc. business card and the Issues Etc. bulletin board flyer. Simply go to the support page at issuesetc.org, click Issues Etc. business cards, print the page on suitable stock paper, and cut along the lines. We also have an 8.5 by 11 inch flyer for the bulletin board at your church. Issuesetc.org, go to the support page, click Issues Etc. bulletin board flyer, and print.
Let me ask you one question. Is your money that good? Or will it buy you forgiveness? Do you think that it could?
Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're talking about the parable of the unjust steward, concluding our five-part daily series on interpreting the parables with Dr. Ken Bailey. Back to the interview. Before the break, he said that this steward, this manager, is not being commended for his dishonesty, but, to put it in Dr. Bailey's terms, for knowing which way to jump. Well, what did he mean by that?
That is, trust explicitly in the fact that your master is a generous man, and if you put all of your eggs into this basket, you will be saved. He will reach out with his generosity and mercy and extend unmerited grace to you. Don't play tricks with him. Don't pretend that you are not a sinner. Don't tell him, look, well, it wasn't my fault, it was this, it was that, it's other people. Don't offer any excuses. Throw yourself upon his mercy, and it will turn out to your having been saved. Okay, now, if you misunderstand that, if you think it looks like the guy's being praised not for his brains at knowing which way to jump, but because he's a liar and a thief, keep reading, my friend. The very next few verses will tell you that if you are not totally faithful with the money that is in your hands, you will never be able to understand the gospel.
The master says to his steward, in effect, you know me all too well.
Right.
And he is perhaps even touched that the steward who has been dishonest with him understands him to be the merciful and generous man that he is.
Absolutely. It's a backhanded compliment in Middle Eastern culture.
Now, Jesus closes in verse 8 with these words, "For the sons of this age are more shrewd in the relation to their own kind than the sons of light." What is he saying there?
The literal is the sons of light of this age are wiser than the sons of this age are wiser than the sons of light in their own generation. But that's a good translation. I didn't catch you. I didn't say anything because I like it. It's got a nice ring to it, and I think it's fair to the text. This language is used by the Dead Sea Scrolls. It was the language of first century Judaism. What he's really saying is, here is a very sharp, shrewd steward who is able to figure out my only hope is not to offer excuses, not to say it wasn't my fault, not to blame others, not to try and wiggle out of it, but to accept the full weight of the judgment that is upon me and throw myself upon the mercy of my master. And the master understands that, and so he then is going to respond by letting the guy walk out the door as the hero of the community. The community will find out that it was a very clever trick, and they will not trust him, but they will give him another job. We want the guy working for us and not for them. He's too smart to work for them. The thing really has got, very dry humor that shows up three or four times in the story. So Jesus is saying, look, this guy out there in this world of masters and stewards and accounts and farming and rents and reducing rents, he's smart enough to figure out how to move ahead. I wish, says Jesus, the sons of light had that same intelligence. I'm not praising this guy for his ethics. I'm praising him for his intelligence.
And that he knew his master.
Exactly. And he knew to offer excuses. You see, when he walks out without trying to defend himself, he's saying, I'm guilty. He is saying, my master knows. As we would say in Arabic, "Ainu maftuha," his eye is open. He knows. He's got me nailed to the wall, and there's no way I'm going to wiggle out of this one. So which way am I going to jump? I will throw myself on the unqualified mercy of my master. My master will understand that it is a compliment, and he will respond out of his own deepest nature, which is to offer me the grace which I so desperately at this point need.
The picture of God. This is the parable is told in the world of farmers, of rich landowners, and of estate managers. The picture of God, and the people cannot miss that the master must be their God.
Absolutely.
How does this correct a misconception on their part about who God is and how he deals with people who are indebted and dishonest with him?
The tendency of the time was to say God loves the righteous and he doesn't like sinners. And so when you keep the law in a precise fashion, this guarantees for you the grace of God. If you break the law, and then this guarantees that you're going to have nothing but the wrath of God. The idea that God loves sinners is there in the Old Testament loud and clear, but it was fading in the day of Jesus and the kind of intellectual climate that was developing around him. And the Pharisaic world was saying God loves the righteous and God despises the sinners. All right, now here is a sinner, loud and clear, and he is the one who does not try and say, I'm innocent. And he throws himself upon the mercy of the master, as we mentioned, like the prodigal does with his father, and the grace of the master is extended to him.
Now then, in verses 9 through 13 in Luke chapter 16, Jesus, you would contend, is doing what he so often does. He's picking up on a theme, but he's going on to say something else, using the same figures and the same elements of speech.
Some of the same language shows up, but I am deeply convinced that it's a new subject. And the subject is, okay, you're not a steward working for someone else, but you do have a certain amount of material things that is under your in your possession. Now, what are you going to do with it? And how are you going to respond to it? And he says a number of very, very important things. One is, if you cheat on your income tax, you're never going to understand the gospel. The second thing he says is that this doesn't belong to you. It belongs to God, and you are what you, if you have not been faithful in what is another's, that is, all of your material possessions belong to others. They do not belong to you. And then the third thing he says is, you can't serve two masters. You cannot serve God and mammon. Namely, that's why mammon is called unrighteous. It presses constantly. It sits on my shoulder and grabs me by the ear and starts to twist my ear and says to me very, very subtly, quite often so subtly that I don't even know that that's what's happening to me. It says, you will make all of your major decisions on the basis of the bottom line. You'll play all kinds of tricks to convince yourself you're not doing this. But I'm your master, and I'm telling you that I'm going to call the shots. Money always does that to us. And so Jesus loud and clear says, you got to make up your mind. Either you listen to that voice and you serve money, or you serve God and you're not going to serve both of them.
Well, money can buy all sorts of things. It can even buy happiness if happiness is what you want, but it makes a lousy God, doesn't it?
It sure does.
It's a demanding God, a God that when it's gone, it's gone.
That's
and
right.
You got to earn him back.
and he says, look, you're supposed to, that's the beginning of this, make for yourselves friends from the unrighteous mammon so that when it fails, that is, at death, you're going to lose it all, they may receive you. This is a passive, and the passive is a way of talking about God. Use your money in a fashion that will please God. Lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven. This is another way of saying it. Of lay up rather than treasures in this life, lay up treasures in heaven, and here it's put in a different and very brilliant way, and so this little poem about mammon, about money, and about faithfulness comes and follows after the great parable about grace and about a gracious master, which should be attached to the story of the prodigal son, rather than attached to the discussion of mammon which follows. The discussion about mammon, I think, is an introduction to the parable which follows, which is the parable about the rich man and Lazarus.
Dr. Bailey, thank you very much for your time.
You're very welcome.
Dr. Ken Bailey is author and lecturer in Middle Eastern New Testament studies. He spent 40 years living and teaching New Testament in Egypt, Lebanon, Jerusalem, and Cyprus, and he's author of numerous books, including Finding the Lost, Cultural Keys to Luke 15. Folks, if you've enjoyed our series this week on interpreting parables with Dr. Ken Bailey, please consider making a tax-deductible gift this weekend. Any size gift is deeply appreciated. You can donate by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio. Send it to LPR Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Here's the address again, LPR Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also make a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. Thanks for listening. Thanks for thinking of us, especially during these difficult summer months. Monday on Issues Etc., we'll be talking with Dr. Paul Meyer of Western Michigan University about the writings of late 3rd century Roman historian and bishop Eusebius. When we actually pay attention to what Jesus says in these parables, to the text of the New Testament itself in these parables, we find that what Jesus is showing us, especially here in this last one we dealt with, a God of great generosity, of immeasurable mercy and forgiveness, a God who is love, a God who loves sinners, even in their fallen state, and yet does not leave them in their fallen and lost state. He loves them, he redeems them, he buys them back, he searches for them, he finds them, he saves them, he brings them to repentance. He does not wait for them to return, but he goes to them in the person, in the very flesh of his Son, Jesus Christ, all the way to the cross, to show his mercy, his forgiveness, his love for us. I'm Todd Wilkin. Talk with you again Monday. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.